All right, well, thank you again for the Valley Athletic Trainers Association for having me here at SPETS. This is my third year in a row, and I can echo a lot of the folks' statements that I've already said. This is one of the best conferences to come and present at. So, before we get started, we do have to go through some disclosures. I did have financial assistance from the Valley Athletic Trainers Association to come out here for this conference. However, outside of that, I don't have any commercial interest or any commercial representations. So let's get into this, and we're going to start off with the most obvious question that most of you guys probably had for this presentation, which is going to be, what is a glass cannon? We hear the part about the high maintenance, high talent athletes, but when we're talking about a glass cannon, this is where my nerd side comes out a little bit, and it's actually going to be a gamer term. And whenever you're talking about a glass cannon, this is something that's incredibly powerful, has great offense, but you hit it one time and it's done. Doesn't work after that. Realistically speaking, we don't really know what that means for athletic training if this is all we have to go off of. So we have to figure out what that means for us. And like John said, whenever I was talking about UT Tyler, we have some very successful athletics programs, and they're successful because of the student athletes that are in those programs. So we have a patient population that's used to performing at a high level. However, there were some trends we started to notice as time went on. So, to kind of talk about what the glass cannon is, we have four cases to talk about to start with. Our first one is going to be a collegiate baseball player that came to us when he was 21 years old. He was a collegiate or junior college transfer that was a second and third baseman during his time with us. And we'll start with his accolades. So, this guy was two-time all-conference. From the second he walked on campus, he was one of the best players in the conference. He was also one of our best statistical players. He batted .377 and finished his season with 7 doubles and 2 home runs. So for a middle infielder, those are fairly decent statistics. On the opposite side of that, he also was dealing with IT band friction syndrome that was in conjunction with the previous tibial plateau fracture. He had scapular dyskinesis, triceps brachii tendonitis, and multiple rib subluxations. And with him, kind of the biggest injury that he ran into was a partial thickness supraspinatus tear that ultimately we had to have surgically debrided so that way it could scar down and heal properly. So, there we go. So right in there you can see where he had a pretty significant tear. So again, lots of accolades, lots of injuries. Next athlete on the opposite side of the sports world is going to be a 22-year-old distance runner that we had. Now with this athlete here, he was one of our middle distance guys, ran the 800 and the 1500, spent his time with us earning the Outstanding Athletic or Male Track Athlete of the Year award, as well as being a conference championship in the 1500 and the 800. So this again is another very talented athlete, and when we talk about him having IT band friction syndrome, this is going to make a little more sense than our baseball player, because he's running on uneven surfaces, he's running long distances. It's pretty natural for something in your lower extremity to start hurting after that. He also ended up having a nagging soleus strain that over time started to develop into Achilles tendonitis despite best efforts with rehab, and then also developed hamstring tendonitis and snapping hip syndrome, which we found later on was related to trochanteric bursitis. So again, a lot of these injuries make a lot of sense for a distance runner, but it's just the amount and the sheer volume of injuries that you're having in just this one successful athlete. So our third case is going to be a 21-year-old female collegiate softball player, and she was one of the pitchers for her team, and over her time with us, she was a 4-time All-American, she was a 4-time All-Region player, she was the Conference Pitcher of the Year, she was All-Conference, and she was All-Division. So this is a girl that was probably one of the better pitchers that has come through the NCAA Division III level. But whenever we were managing her care, once again, IT band friction syndrome rears its head. She also developed some scapular dyskinesis and had some chronic ankle instability to the point to where she was having to wear a brace to pitch every game, even though she was not hitting or base running or anything of that nature. She also had hypoglycemia, which again, that can be kind of tied more behavioral related. And then she also developed multiple blisters, which again, it doesn't make too far of a stretch for us to sit there and think that this is what this girl had going on. But again, we're looking at volume of injuries versus types of injuries here. And then our last subject, or case number 4, was a 22-year-old baseball player that played outfield and designated hitter during his 2 years with us. Again, it's another JUCO transfer, another good athlete. And over his time with us, he was the player of the year in our conference. He was the conference newcomer of the year the same year, first team all-division, first team all-region, honorable mention all-American, and then his last year he wrapped it up with first team all-conference and third team all-region honors. Now when we go through his injury list, though, we start off with lateral ankle sprains, and he developed chronic ankle instability at that point. He had hamstring strains, he had groin strains, multiple rib subluxations, several concussions, labrum tear, and a subscapularis rupture that wrapped up the rest of his career. And whenever we say rupture, we mean rupture. So again, this is a big, acute, explosive injury. So that's not really going to be the end-all predictor for, okay, what's the big deal with talking about what does his performance have to do with that? But at the same time, again, we're looking at the volume. For every accolade, there was an injury. So as we were looking at these athletes, we had to sit there and ask ourselves as a department, we have these great teams, we have this great statistical output. It's doing great, we're having a good time, we're patting each other on the back, but these kids keep getting injured. They keep having to come in, we keep having to see our patient population increase with the more success that our programs are having. So after a point, we sat back and we said, what do these kids have in common? What's the common thread here? It's not the same injuries a lot of times. It's not the same sport, it's not the same position. So we weren't really able to point to any injury or movement patterns that were pinning these kids in a predisposed situation. What we did know and what they all had in common was that for their respective teams that were very successful, they were some of the top performers on those highly successful teams. And they were looked to as leaders. I mean, if you talked about any of these people by name, you'll sit there and you'll know that their teammates count them as the folks that they were depending on for the success of their teams. And like we talked about already, they all were highly prone to injury and had a high volume of injuries during their time at UT Tyler. So going back to what the glass cannon is, again, from the gamer term, it's going to be amazing offense and amazingly terrible defense. Now, whenever we're talking about our athletic training, sports medicine world, and we're talking about our patient population, we can correlate a glass cannon to being somebody that had great statistical output, was a great performer, one of the top players on their team, but was also highly involved in injuries and had a high incidence of injuries. And as we sit there and we talk about that, you're sitting there and you're mentally going through all the kids on your teams that are your top kids, but they're always coming in to see you, they're always spending time in your clinic, they're always having some sort of new injury. And what we were trying to figure out then at that point is what was so significant about this being the common thread that these kids had. So whenever we talk about why is this important, why is this something we need to learn about, we have to go back to our five domains of athletic training. So we have to go back to basics. We're going to start with injury, illness, prevention, and wellness protection. So again, that's the most common, one of the more core ones that we have. We're here to take care of these kids. We're here to make sure that our patient population stays happy and healthy. Next, we have our clinical evaluation and diagnosis. Somebody gets injured, you take a look at them, you determine if you need to send them to a physician. And then you take care of that immediate emergency care. You deal with the acute triage of injuries, and then you make your decisions about referral, whether you need to send them or not. And then we have treatment and rehabilitation. Once we determine what the significance of that injury is, we have to take care of it at that point. And then organizing and professional health and well-being, so taking care of some more of our administrative duties. But for the sake of this, we're focusing on that injury, illness, prevention, and wellness protection, because if we know that there's something that's predisposing our patient population to injuries, that's something that we need to be taking care of. That's something we need to be highlighting, something we need to be targeting, and something we need to be trying to have a positive effect on. So what was our pattern here? There's a textbook that came out, not in the near past, that was written up by Granquist and his colleagues. And they pointed out that if we have athletes that are dealing with psychosocial and psychological stresses, they're going to be at about a 2 to 5 time increased risk for having some sort of injury, especially when we compare them to somebody that has lower stress. So right there, whatever stressors may be happening, whether it's general or sport specific, these are going to be things that are going to be placing this population at a higher risk for injury. And why is this placing them at a higher risk for injury? And this is where we get a little bit away from the evidence-based practice talks like we just had before, and this is where it kind of turns more into a sermon versus a lecture. But we have some science that Granquist put forward whenever he was talking about the cortisol cascade. Whenever we're starting at experiencing our stress, that stress is going to have an effect, and it's going to trigger our cerebral cortex to start to have an effect, or to start to move into action. And then from that point, our cerebral cortex is going to get the hypothalamus to start releasing adrenocorticotropic hormone. Once that hormone's being released, it's going to stimulate the release of cortisol. And when we talk about cortisol, a lot of people talk about one of its metabolites, which is going to be cortisone. We always talk about cortisone injections in athletes. Whenever we were listening to the other talks the other day, we talked about how cortisone injections are going to help decrease inflammation but delay healing. So you're feeling a little bit better at the time. Well, cortisol is going to be a step up in terms of that chemical cascade. And whenever we're looking at what cortisol's effects have on the body, we know that it can be linked with chronic stress. So you have somebody that's stressed and their body's releasing another chemical that's going to increase their stress levels. It can be linked with depression. So again, sticking on that psychosocial side of things. And then it can also help suppress our immune system. So now it's going to be starting to delay and impede healing and also put us at an increased risk for injury. So again, they were talking about in their textbook that you're 2 to 5 times higher risk for injury if you have higher levels of stress. Well, if we can help our patients decrease their stress, then we're going to be able to put them in a situation where we can decrease pain, we can decrease fear of re-injury, and ultimately we may even be able to improve healing outcomes. So this is where we started to see a couple of things that were starting to make a bit of sense with our athletes. We had these athletes that were going through these high levels of stress because they had coaches, parents, boosters, administrators, teammates, in some cases professors asking about the game. So these kids were having people come at them from all sides, assailing them and telling them, hey, you're really important to this team. And they're sitting there basically saying, yeah, I know. Thanks for adding on to the stress. There's no pressure at all for us to do well this year. Thanks a lot. So what can we do about it as a profession? What is the athletic trainer's role in helping with this stress? And again, this is whenever it gets into a little bit more abstract thinking, a little bit more that sermon that I talked about. And we need to understand that whenever we have even stress in our lives, we're going to start with our initial survey of that stress. And basically, as we're going through that primary appraisal of that stress, we're asking ourselves, is this a threat? Is this something that I need to address, or is this something that I can just sweep under the rug and move on from? And in keeping with that, this is going to be a situation where if we do determine that this is a threat, then we start our secondary appraisal. And when we start our secondary appraisal, this is whenever we're sitting there and we're saying, okay, what's the threat? What do I have to combat that threat? How do I need to go about combating that threat? Do I fight? Do I flight? What route do I take whenever I'm trying to get away from this? So whenever they're going through that primary phase of this appraisal may take minutes, could take hours. But at the same time, even if we're having to wait until that secondary phase, this is going to be a situation where the athletic trainer is going to be the primary person that's in a position to intervene. Because anytime we're talking about injuries, anytime we're talking about stress, you're that one that's there getting them ready for practice. You're that one that's there helping them with rehab, helping them with their injuries that they may be having. You're the one that's the first person on the field a lot of times if they get injured, if their coach doesn't beat you out there in that race. And as you're evaluating them, you're the one sitting there, whether it's just putting a hand on their shoulder and saying, hey, you're going to be okay. You're already starting to intervene when they're going through that appraisal. And that's where we have to sit there and we have to step up and say, okay, well, what are we going to do to try to combat this psychosocial side of injury? So, like I said, we get to the point where they're starting to figure out how they're going to address that injury. And we need to point out to ourselves and look at some of our athletes and figure out what their risk factors are going to be that are going to possibly send them further down that stress cascade that's going to either lead to that injury taking longer or making them even more stressed and make them more prone to further injury later on. So we have our risk factors that we have to identify, like I said. We're going to break those down into 3 major categories. The first of those categories is going to be personality, followed up by history of stressors and coping resources. So when we look at personality, this is going to be a very stable trait. This is going to be our hardiness. And a lot of times people, and you all know somebody on both sides of this, where you have your optimist and your pessimist. So you know those people that there's nothing that can get them down. They're having a great day and nothing's going to stop them. And you also have that person that it doesn't matter what good happens, they're always going to be upset. They're always going to find some negative in it. They're always going to find some reason why it's not working out and why the world is still terrible. And like I said, this is a stable trait. This isn't something that we can necessarily affect, and we can only do so much with this one. But we need to make sure that we're recognizing this as something that is a risk factor and something that we incorporate into our plan of care. The next one is going to be history of stressors. So again, stress doesn't stop with sports. Even though these kids are having all this pressure put on them by everyone around them, The stress cannot just be, or stress isn't always just this. It can be moving. You have kids that have just moved into your school district, kids that just got to college. Anytime any of us have ever moved, there's been at least one or two stressful situations in that. It's no different for your patients. The next one's gonna be financial stress, whether it's mom lost a job and we're trying to figure out where the money's coming from, whether it's a situation where you have a college athlete that's worried about losing a scholarship. Things along those lines are gonna be huge. And then romantic stress. We all have had that athlete before, especially whether we're talking high school, college level, people are walking through there. You're young, you're in love, this is the end all be all, I'm gonna marry this person, you're writing your name with their last name, and a week later you're dating someone else. So, this is one of those situations whenever we look at things like that, that romantic stress, especially in our patient population, going from say 13 to 22, this one can be a pretty big overall life stress that can have some problems. Now, additionally, even if we're not talking about these big global ones, it can just be daily hassles. You could have just hit a lot of traffic on your way to school or on your way to college, and that made you late for class. So you're heading out to practice, you're already kind of stressed out, and now those cortisol levels are up, and now your risk of injury has gone up. Another big one's gonna be previous injuries. If you've ever had that kid, and we all have, ACL patient, goes out to practice, gets tackled or gets rolled up on, feels a little bit of a shift, and the world is over. Everything's terrible. You walk up, you do Lachman's, hey, your ACL's still there. They pop up, they go right back to practice. So again, that's something where they have that fear of re-injury in the back of their mind. That's putting them at a situation where that's adding on to those stress levels, and we're just getting that cumulative effect of things that's causing more cortisol to be introduced into the system. It's putting these kids at a higher risk for injury. And then we have coping resources. And this is a risk factor only if these people don't have a lot of coping resources or their coping resources aren't that good. Because these are gonna be the tools that your athlete or your patient has to try to combat whatever stressors are affecting them or whatever perceived threat that they're dealing with. And like I said, this can be a very good thing if these are the right types of coping resources because they can act as a buffer for your athlete's personality. And so if it's a situation where you have that athlete that's super negative about the world, but they have a parent that's really helping motivate them, uplift them, staying positive, that can at least mitigate that issue. And likewise, it can also help with those previous stressors where you have those people around them, you have those coping resources to sit there and tell them, hey, it's not that bad, let's go ahead and get a look at it. Even if it gets to the point of having to go see the doctor, let's not freak out until after they've looked at it. So again, these are ways that we're helping decrease stress as we're moving through there. So when we look at our sources for coping, the first one that pops up is family. And again, this can be a two-sided coin. This can be a situation where you have those parents that are super awesome, they're supporting the athletic trainers, they're supporting the team physicians, and they're just there to help keep their kid in a good mood and keep their mindset right so they can heal properly. You can also have that parent that's second-guessing you every way, and we've all had them, that's being in some cases borderline combative, and it's just not making it a situation that makes things go well. And those are the times whenever I'm glad I work at a college where I have an 18-year-old patient that I can sit there and say, you are no longer their legal guardian, you need to leave. However, that's not always gonna be the case at our different levels of care. They also are gonna have friends on their side, so you can have the same thing here. We can have positive friends that are a positive coping resource, or you can have those negative friends. Significant others are going to be a big one. Just like they can be part of your history of stressors, they can also be part of your coping resources. And this is one of the even bigger two-sided coins when we look at our young patient population because of just how dynamic and may not be the best word, but how volatile some of these relationships can be. So that's one of those ones where you definitely kind of have to sit there and decide if that's really a coping resource for the good or for the bad. Likewise, you're also going to have teammates that can have negative or positive influences. And lastly, like I said, that person that's gonna be in that primary position to intervene whenever those stressors start to hit, whether it's before or after injury, that's gonna be your sports medicine professional. So we keep talking about how we're the primary ones in position, we have the power, we're the ones that are right there. What can we do? Well, Santi et al. Published a paper where they put forth the idea that whenever we have to look at injuries, athletic trainers and healthcare professionals in general are terrible about seeing an ACL tear and not seeing a women's soccer player, or seeing a rotator cuff rupture and not seeing a collegiate baseball player. We look at injuries as the enemy, we attack it, we throw everything we have at it, And a lot of times we let that patient fall by the wayside and we don't sit there and we pay attention to what's going on with them. Because yes, that ACL tear hurt. Yes, rehab is going horribly. I'm sore, I'm stiff, I'm not getting the gains I want. But at the same time, we have to remember things like fear of re-injury, decreased compensation. So this can be something that starts off nowadays with all these NCAA recruitment rules as early as the beginning of high school and sometimes eighth grade, where you have a kid that has an injury and they were counting on a scholarship because that's how they were going to get to go to college. And again, even if it turns out just to be a scare, not an actual injury, it turns into a situation where now that stress has gone up, cortisol goes up, increased risk of injury. So we keep coming back to that. And there's also going to be a sensation of loss. In the last talk, they talked about loss of identity. So it's not just going to be a compensation thing. It's not going to necessarily be tactile or tangible. It can be something that is more abstract, something that you're sitting there and you're saying, wow, I can't go to this trip. I can't travel with my team to the playoffs after I helped get them there. And again, even if it's just a scare, we're still increasing stress. And we keep coming back to that because that's going to be important for what we can do whenever we get down to the end of this. So the first step that may be something that can help out in a lot of cases is going to be screening your patients. And sometimes this can be as simple as knowing your athletes and knowing that patient population that you have. If you've had a kid that's a senior and they just seem off today, it can be as simple as asking them, hey, you seem like you're having a bad day. What's going on? And just listening to them, giving them an outlet, giving them some way to try to decrease that stress by using one of their coping resources, which would be you, the sports medicine professional. So that way we can try to put them in a situation where they're not necessarily having as much issues once they get to the field. Also, getting to know your patient population doesn't just stop at knowing the individual. Yes, we have to worry about patient to patient, but there are patterns we start to see in adolescent males and females to where you can tell if somebody's had a bad day or a rough time and is being more aggressive, is being more moody, just overall more emotional, to where you can sit there and talk to an athlete you may not even know that well and still be able to have that conversation to try to help start decreasing that stress. And whenever you're doing your preseason physicals, you can possibly even incorporate a health questionnaire, which the best one I found, even though I couldn't find a great picture of it or couldn't get a great screenshot of it for this, was the Life Event Survey for college athletes. And they also have secondary school ones, but with the collegiate athlete one, it's based off of a 1 to 5 scale, and it allows you to sit there and say, okay, this is the base level of stress this person's coming in with, and it helps you identify those kids that may have higher level of stresses to start with and could help prevent some problems down the road if you actually go ahead and start helping them out with identifying coping resources and ways they can do a little bit better with managing that stress. And likewise, we can also talk about adding to coping resources. And this is the part of the presentation where I have to make sure that we mention, to make sure we're all staying in good conscience and making sure everything's staying legal, the fact that we are sports medicine professionals, we are athletic trainers, we are highly skilled, we have multiple skills, we're the Swiss Army knife of the sports medicine world. We are not psychological healthcare professionals. If you have a stressed athlete, it's awesome to be able to sit there and help them cope with that. If you have an athlete where you even have an inkling and an idea in your head that there may be a little bit more going on than stress, that it may be a situation where there needs to be a mental health care professional involved, the second you have that thought is the second that you refer them. But in the meantime, when you're going through rehab and you're taking them through the progression, or even if it's just a situation where you have them on a preventative program, you might be helping out with the strength and conditioning program at your high school. You can start working on things like motivational techniques. The first one, and the easiest place to see this will be rehab, is going to be goal setting. Likewise, having positive self-talk to where this person, even if they're a pessimist, you can start training them how to do positive self-talk, and thought stopping. So, like I said, for our profession, goal setting is going to be the easiest one for us to implement. And whenever you were going through your rehabilitation classes, we talked about a lot of the stuff where we had to make sure we set a very specific goal. It's not enough to say that I want my athlete or my patient to do better, and they want to be able to play better, and they want to be able to play well, because better, well, and good are very non-specific, very subjective terms that we don't have anything attached to. So when you're talking about setting specific goals, you're saying, we want to get you 5 degrees of extension back this week. Something like that, that they can actually sit there and hang their hat on. Because then when they meet that goal, now they have something to point to and say, okay, cool, I got my 7 degrees of motion, so I actually did better than my goal. You also want to make sure it's measurable for that same reason. You want to give them something that they can have tangible, something that they can see, and not just something that they have to think or feel about, because when we start trying to rely on thinking and feeling, now we can start increasing stress again, increasing cortisol, increasing risk of injury. And then we want to make sure our goals are realistic. You're not going to take your ACL patient and say, all right, we're going to have you get in a 36-inch vertical 2 months post-op. Again, we just want to make sure that we're doing this in a situation where we're able to stimulate these athletes with these goals, we're able to motivate them to continue doing rehab, but we don't make the goals so unrealistic and unobtainable that they're not able to actually reach those goals, and now they're actually getting demotivated. They didn't reach that goal, so that stress level goes up. And we also want to make sure that our goals are time-based, and I'm not talking about 10, 20 seconds. I'm talking about within the first 2 weeks, we want to be able to get that 10 degrees of extension back that you lost, things like that. Additionally, when we get to that self-talk, thought-stopping process, this is one of those ones where it starts to sound a little bit like a self-help seminar or a motivational speech, but this is going to be something where you have the athlete actually sit there and express what they're thinking, express what they're feeling. Tell them, make them say, I'm frustrated because I don't think I'm going to get back to playing. I'm frustrated because I know that guy's taking my spot. And then you have to sit there and tell them, okay, which parts of those thoughts are negative? And then once you figure out which thoughts are negative, you need to try to look at them in a positive light. Yeah, that guy has my spot right now, but he's getting better by getting reps. He's getting better, and it's going to motivate me to do better whenever I get back out there. And just kind of reframe your position on the matter. And then you kind of have to select a statement or a mantra whenever you're going through this, and then you're going to say or read that statement as many times as that patient needs to, so that way they can go ahead and kind of just get that thought out of their mind and get back down to that lower stress level. And then this is going to help them, like I said, maintain that positive attitude. We're going to avoid some demotivation, things like that. And they're going to be able to go out there and they're going to be able to participate again. Another big one that's really helpful for us as we're going through rehab and performance is going to be biofeedback. So this is basically using electronic or mechanical equipment to give us some sort of feedback about the state that the person's body is going to be in. One of the more expensive ones, it's not really going to be feasible for those of us in this room, since most of us aren't going to be working in a laboratory setting, it's going to be an EMG. This electrical readout of the activity of the muscle is going to give you some awesome quantifiable evidence. Not really going to be very feasible for us to do in a Division III college or in a 2A high school. However, what we can do is we can measure heart rate, things like that. You have that kid that's going out there and they're participating and they say, man, I just feel like I'm gassed, I feel like I can't do this. Well, go ahead and just take your heart rate real quick. You don't have to actually check a number, just see if your heart's racing, see where you're at with that point, and then they find out, oh, my heart's not beating as hard as I thought it was. I must be getting better. Same thing we can say with blood pressure. And all these numbers are nice quantifiable numbers that are going to give that athlete or that patient feedback on what state they are in physiologically and helps them change their interpretation of their symptoms. If they're sitting there and they're sucking wind, but their pulse is still decent, now they're able to sit there and say, okay, yeah, I'm getting better, I'm improving. And then another thing that we have to make sure that we look at for these kids is going to be some sort of social support-based interventions. So when we look at these types of interventions, there's going to be four main ones that we have: emotional, concrete, informational, and appraisal. So when we look at our emotional side of stuff, we're going to have various sources for this. We're going to have professionals, so your athletic trainers, your team physicians, your coaches. You're going to have these people around that can either help them out with just seeing where they are emotionally, talking to them about why they may be having some negative thoughts, and kind of helping them on from that standpoint. The professionals are also going to be there to provide them with some sort of concrete or instrumental evidence like, hey, we're putting a bat in your hands because you're able to progress through your rehab. You have something in your hands you didn't have before because you're getting better. You're doing more stuff that's related to your sport because you're doing better. And then also, these are going to be the same people that are going to be primarily there for appraisal. It could be something as simple as having a coach watch a bullpen with you for a pitcher and say, yeah, you're starting to look a lot more like yourself. Now they're getting this great feedback. They're getting support from their coaches. It's not just them and the athletic trainer hanging out in the athletic training room doing TheraBand exercises. Now we're incorporating more people. They're feeling more like they're part of something again. And you can say the same thing with family and friends, whether it's teammates or just friends that are out there in their normal student population. These are going to be other people that can still help them be part of something. Because again, these guys are going to be sitting there feeling like they've lost their sense of identity. They've lost their sense of self. We're not part of a team anymore. And now they're able to sit back and say, I am still part of my team. I'm not participating with my team right now, but I still have all these other social support groups. And peers, again, with our kids, this can be something as simple as coaches and teammates, but at the same time, this is also something, and I'm sure most of you guys have done this before, where their peer may not even play their sport, their peer may not even go to school with them, but it's somebody that they know within the community that they live in that has gone through something similar. You have a kid that has an ACL tear, and they're a freshman in high school, and they're freaking out because they don't know what's going to go on with it, what's going to come of it. Well, just so happens you have a senior on your same team that had an ACL tear as well, went through the rehab, had good outcomes. Hey, do you mind going and talking to him, just letting him know about the process that you went through and giving it to him on a level that's a little different than what I can do? So this also helps give them that support and help decrease that stress and that fear of re-injury. Next up, Ryan and Desi talked about the fact that we are the people that, again, are prime position. We keep saying that we're in the prime position to intervene. We're in the prime position to help these people because, again, whether it's pre-injury or post-injury, we are the ones that have the most contact with them. So this is a situation where we also are able to help move them from extrinsic to intrinsic motivation. And this is a situation where at some point with an injury, and again, these phases can go quickly, they can go short, but your patients are always going to start off demotivated. And this can be something that lasts a matter of seconds. Because when we start off in demotivation, we're at non-regulatory behaviors and we have no intention to act. This is a situation, sometimes, like I said, can last until the kid gets off the field. You feel the pop in your knee, you're laying on the ground, you're saying, this is it, I'm done, I can't move my knee, I don't want to walk, I don't want to do anything. Athletic trainer gets out there and starts talking to him and says, hey, you're all right, bud, let's get you up, let's get you off the field. All right, fine, I'll walk. So now we've ended demotivation. So to start off with, we all need some sort of external regulation. We need that carrot at the end of the stick that makes us want to actually keep moving forward. And typically, when we start off, we're going to have to go as simple as rewards and punishment. Hey, you did really well with this, so we'll do the ice and stim treatment that you like. Even though we're not necessarily sure it does anything, it's keeping you compliant with your rehab. And also with punishments. So that can be something like, if you work it out with your coaches, you missed rehab, you have an extra 2 hours of study hall this week. Then once we start to move them away from that at least a little bit, we start to get some behavioral changes once they get to that interjected regulation. And it's still not really positive if you look at it, because you note that it's going to be driven by avoiding guilt or trying to achieve those rewards. So they're still trying to obtain that external praise, that external regulation, but now they're doing it more so because they want to and not because of just the fear of it. And then we move on to identified regulation, where now it becomes a free choice. Yeah, it's great to not feel guilty. Yeah, it's great to get my rewards, but ultimately at the same time, now we're able to start identifying, yeah, I'm doing this because of these external factors, and I probably should be doing this more for me than for that. And that's whenever we move on to integrated regulation, which it's still going to be extrinsically motivated, but at the same time, now they have that intent to move on. Now they're starting to integrate more intrinsic methods and more internal motivation, and now they're starting to take it as part of their personal identity. And then that finally moves us on to intrinsic motivation. This is that highest level. This is the gold standard of self-determination. And I can speak for myself, and I can imagine there's most of us, that we have a hard time just even getting up in the morning just based off of intrinsic motivation after a long day. So this is where we're able to finally internally regulate all our behaviors. We're doing the rehab because we want to and because we know it's what we need to do. And this whole process is going to be a shifting scale, and it's going to be sliding as we go through it. You're going to move from one phase to the other throughout this process, and a lot of times you're going to go through different phases multiple times, especially if this is going to be one of those more long, drawn-out rehabs. But again, this is something that we can help facilitate and something that we can monitor and something that we can help move forward a little better and have fewer slides backwards using those different methods we talked about before. So kind of starting our conclusion start, let's go ahead and talk about, again, the fact that we have these patient population with these athletes that perform at a high level. They're the successful ones on their team. They're driving the success of their team. And these are the people that within their sport are subjected to a very specific level of stresses. If we've never been a guy that was a potential Division I draft pick or Division I player to draft pick, something like that, it's hard for us to completely relate with those people. However, at the same time, whenever we have these athletes that are coming through with these higher levels of stresses, we are able to at least recognize, hey, I'm not sure exactly why he's this stressed about this. I don't necessarily understand it. But at the same time, I do recognize the fact that it's putting him at a higher risk for physical injury, and that's an issue. And as we do this, we are athletic trainers. We look back to those five domains, and we look at injury prevention and protection, and we realize that this is our patient population, and we have a duty, we have an obligation to take care of these people and take whatever steps we have available to us to try to prevent that patient population from sustaining further injuries, or at the very least, being at a higher risk for those injuries. And the easiest way for us to do that, and you can put easiest in big quotations, is we can start to take steps to identify those athletes with higher levels of stress and start to work on ways that we can help treat them and help develop plans that we can incorporate within their rehabilitation or their prehab programs to just kind of incorporate some stress management techniques to try to keep them at a lower level of risk for injury or re-injury. So, fortunately for all of us, we don't have to develop our own exact method of screening because the Journal of Athletic Training posted an interassociation recommendation where they took people from multiple different areas and they'd have a multidisciplinary team that put together a document that specifically for the secondary school or for the high school was able to help figure out how to identify and how to refer these kids and then put it together in a consensus statement. And within this multidisciplinary team, they put together a group back in 2014 so they could release in 2015, but this group started obviously with athletic trainers. Again, we're on the front line, we're the ones that need to be out there, and we're the ones that need to be part of this team. It also included physicians because that's that next level. We're the ones referring to physicians, so the physicians may run into this as well. And we, again, since we are not licensed healthcare professionals, made sure that there were some licensed healthcare professionals on that team. And then another one that some of us don't necessarily think about every day that we made sure we were on that team were lawyers. So with those lawyers, they're there because a lot of times in this secondary school, with a very small exception, these kids are minors. So there's going to be parental or at the very least legal guardian consent that's going to be involved in any kind of treatment, whether it's physical or emotional. So the first step they recommended is that you need to develop a personal plan that works for your school district. And in order to do that, you need to show a need for your plan. So you need to say, hey, we have a situation where we're bringing you this plan, we're showing you our introduction, this is what we're putting together. Now you start to build up why. You talk about education on mental health status, mental health issues, and a lot of times they make mention of calling them psychological concerns because, again, we cannot diagnose psychological illnesses, but we can definitely be concerned about the psychological state of our patient population. And then pointing out our different behaviors that we need to monitor. So listing off, these are the things that you need to keep an eye on to be seeing if you have a patient that's at risk. And then talking about the special needs of that student athlete, talking about those specific stressors that may be placed on them. And then talking about the school district's referral procedure, talking about what's our threshold before we start to send them to either the school counselor, a school designated psychiatrist or psychologist. Who's that next level up and at what point do we pull the trigger and go ahead and have them go talk with them? Once you do this and once you've built that plan up and once you have that first draft ready, you need to share that plan with your school nurse, your school counselor, and the administration at your school or your university. Because those counselors and those nurses are going to be the other people that are going to have a lot of contact with these potentially stressed or injured individuals. And then the administration needs to be kept abreast of all this stuff for any possible legal concerns that may pop up. And then after they have a chance to review it, make sure that you send that plan out to all the necessary parties. So make sure every athletic trainer, every team physician, definitely make sure the psychiatrist you're going to be referred or you're going to be referring athletes to knows that you're going to be referring athletes to them if it gets to that point. And then you're going to want to review and update that plan as needed. So this is something that, just like with the rest of our policies and procedures, we should be updating them annually. But if this is a new policy that you're putting in for your school, chances are you're going to probably have a few hiccups along the way, just like you do with any new policy or procedure. So there's going to be some updates before that first annual review. But it's all well and good to sit here and we talk about these different things with these kids. We talk about, hey, these were our four kids. This is what we've started doing a little differently to try to help maintain our patient population and try to decrease our risk of injury. These are the recommendations of this great, wonderful interdisciplinary team. However, every individual situation is going to be different, and every individual situation is going to carry its own individual set of challenges. So here are the references. Those will be in the handouts that we'll have at the end of this that get sent out electronically, so that way if you're looking for these different textbooks or different consensus statements, they're a little easier to find. And that's what I have for y'all today.